carry on, because if you're going that soon, yeah, you go on.
If I understand the question correctly, by the shop you mean the broker to the company?
Yes.
The answer is yes, very definitely. If ever we were long a stock or short a stock, the first person that you went to, unless you had a limit order on your book, I'll explain the limit order later, they were the first people that we would go to, because they knew exactly who held the stock. They were in constant touch with the registers. The limit orders that I was referring to, has that been explained in other interviews?
Yes, it has, but you might briefly...
Well, on the left-hand side of your page, opposite your dealing page, you had a list of all the buyers who wanted to buy stock, and on the right-hand side of the page, you had the list of sellers who wanted to sell stock. And that, in the 50s, certainly, and in the 60s as well, I would say until about 67, 68, that was very much a main part of the so-called jobber's turn. The misuse of the jobber's turn, the expression the jobber's turn, has taken place 99 times to 100, because only 1 in 100 times did you buy stock and have a buyer, and then you could pass that stock on. And as time developed, to use that expression, jobber's turn, was anathema to us, because it was absolute crap, because there wasn't any such thing as a jobber's turn. But in the days when we had full limit pages, it was very useful to help us determine a price.
And a firm limit, of course, was absolutely invaluable, because actually, if you had a firm limit, in other words, the chap said, I will leave you 100,000 shares to buy at a pound, you could then call them 19 and tenpence halfpenny to 20 and a penny halfpenny, and if you bought them at 19 and tenpence halfpenny, you then passed them on, and you knew you were going to pass them on. Whereas if you didn't have a firm limit like that, well, you know, you might call them easier and buy them at 19 and 9, and then might sell them at a pound, and then if you went on buying them and didn't sell a share, you would lower the price. So a firm limit was something to be very much valued. And I suppose if you analyse the thing, when you had a firm limit, you were actually, at that particular time, you were acting not only as a principal, you were also an agent. You were the agent of the broker who had left you that limit, and there were very strict conventions as to how much you took out of the firm limit. And it was normally, if I remember rightly, a normal penny halfpenny in the pound was sort of deemed appropriate, which is roughly what his commission was in any case.
And a firm limit, of course, gave the broker who had left that order with the jobber a distinct advantage, because he knew that every stock, all the stock that was bought round the market, was going to come back to him. Because, for instance, say a smaller jobber found that his book was too large and he wanted to call them 19 and 7/10 halfpenny, we used to hear about it and go and take his stock at 19 and 10 halfpenny, because we had the ready-made bar, he didn't. So that the reasons why brokers left the stock with jobbers was because they knew that they were going to execute that order rather quicker than if they had just been buying the stock by walking around the market and dealing in a haphazard fashion.
And then very likely putting the price up against themselves, if they dealt all the way around the market. If they just left it with one, and they were happy to buy their time and weren't in a mad rush. I suppose in latter days what tended to happen with those limits was that they would leave them with you for a shorter period of time, and then they would tend to play the market. In other words, if Wall Street came in and had been 25 points down the previous night, well, then they would lower their price, and therefore it was worth dealing with them. Firm limits were always, well, the tradition was, the convention was that they closed at the end of the day, and then they renewed them again in the morning. But it was a very useful thing to have. From both points of view.
Just going back to the shop brokers very briefly, certainly until the 1980s, what we now call insider trading was not illegal. If a broker did have too close a relationship with a company, could that be taken advantage of by a jobber who might have been very close to the shop?
No, because he would never act as a principal and try and deal directly with the company. He was always, as Robert said, he would just be handing over his stock. It might put him in a privileged position because he's making more penny halfpenny than anybody else within the market. But there's no way that he could have taken advantage of... Well, I don't know. To my knowledge, nobody in my company bought shares PA, if that's what you're referring to, and made themselves rich men. Our senior partners were not rich.
As the jobber, one wouldn't have been human if at times, if you had a firm order from a broker, if it didn't cross your mind, if it was, say, a company which was possibly might be taken over, and if you had a firm order, a broker buying, you would think, well, I wonder who he's dealing for. And of course, one didn't do anything about it, but in your mind you would think, well, I wonder if it's so-and-so, if I wonder if it's so-and-so. And there's a case in point. I remember, for instance, I sold a large number. I think it was two million shares, which was far too many, and it cost the firm a lot of money, in British Sugar. And I had expected that I was going to be able to get these back over a period of time. And then, of course, Beresford, S&W Beresford, made a bid before we'd, an outright bid before we'd had the time to get the shares back. And it was obvious that the 2 million had been bought by Beresford to give them a base from which to launch that bid. But there were times when companies or one dealt in stock, and it would be perfectly innocent. It was funds were getting ever bigger in those days, and they needed a reasonable proportion. And of course, there was no disclosure of you could own 10% or whatever. But then, as of now, I mean, 5%, and then you're over 5%, you've got to declare that. So I suppose that was one of the advantages from a client's point of view of the jobbing system, that it was a secret system, if you like, and things could go on which now would have to be published. I mean, this is, I suppose, why we were slightly apprehensive when the new market maker system came in, because everything has to be in the alpha stocks, have got to be published virtually within seconds. And you would not run the positions, or big bear positions, that one would have run in the old days, because they would be immediately exposed unless you covered them. And so I suppose that has all gone. I doubt that the bears that were sold in those days would ever be sold again, because you're immediately exposed. And let's face it, a bear couldn't go to the moon. I mean, a bull, if you're a bull at a pound, it can only fall to nothing. Whereas a bear at a pound can go to 20 pounds and you'd be out of the stock.
To go back a little bit in time, Bohm, Oldham and Durlacher merger was just the first of several further mergers.
Mm-hmm.
Or takeovers. One of the next big ones being with a firm called Kitchen Baker Shaw.
Yes, Kitchen Baker Mason, and they had merged with Shaw, but P. Shaw before.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes. Now this said in fact, half of the firm went to Durlacher, and another half of the firm went to Wed.
Yes.
Why did that actually happen?
Well, KBM had virtually to do something, because, well, they had the death of one partner in any case, and Wed Jefferson, as it then was, dealt only in gilts, and Dick Wilkins, who was the senior partner and ultimately our chairman, I think he foresaw that, although they had marvellous business in the gilts, that an interest in the industrial equity market would be of some advantage. And so half of them went to Wed initially, and half came to us.
And yet, within a few years,
yes,
you yourselves had joined with Wed.
Yes. Well, put it like this, I think that was a question of personalities. Dick Wilkins with Wed was the king of the gilt market. And Esmond Durlacher, Dick's father, his nickname was the Emperor. And he was the emperor, if you like, of the industrial market. And there was not room for a king and an emperor under the same roof. And when Esmond retired, Nigel Mordaunt, who was the deputy senior partner of the Lacquer firm, was a very great personal friend of Dick Wilkins. They lived close together, they used to travel on the train together. And I think then the two of them saw the logic of having a conglomerate, as it was, including the gilt market and the industrial market. And of course, they were proved very right, because I think the gilts felt that we were the poor relations, because there wasn't that amount of business at the end of the 60s. And actually, it was slightly ironic, because the very first year that we did merge, the gilts had a tough time, and the industrial market actually made more money than the gilts did. But it was a very good thing, because I think the gilt people thought, oh, well, you know, who's this riffraff we've taken on? And it cemented the relationship very well. And it was part of what I was saying originally. You were very fortunate if you were firing on all cylinders at the same time, because business wasn't like that.
How did the people in Whit feel about joining this firm of industrial equity jobbers?
Well, I was one of the firm of the industrial equity jobbers, but I think they felt that perhaps... I think the gilt market had a certain sense or feeling of superiority. And, I mean, they used to march around in rather more top hats than they did in the industrial market, and that I think we soon became pretty good friends.
Did personalities play an important part in the stock exchange or in firms at this time?
Yes, undoubtedly. I remember dear old Pat de Lacquer, who was a cousin of Dick's, and one of the things that one needed to know, you needed to know your stock and a bit about it, but you also needed to know the broker, the individual brokers who were handling the business in that stock. It was very important because, as I say, they're all individuals and they all act and react differently. And some were always easy to get on with, charming, friendly. Some were absolute four-letter men, and you avoided dealing with them if you possibly could, because you knew that either they were unpleasant or B, the business they had tended to be on the warm side. In other words, they certainly knew what they were doing, and you only wanted to deal with them if you knew what you were doing yourself. So personalities played a big part in it, and we used to arrange our jobbing teams so that supposing it was the food market, we had dealers who got on well as individuals with the brokers who were the lead sort of brokers in those stocks. And you always arrange your teams so that you had a partner, possibly quite a senior partner. Then you had a number two who was slightly down the scale, possibly a potential partner. And then you had very much a junior. And one would allow if you were the partner, the broker's partner would most likely want to speak to him, and if it was a big deal, he certainly would, and he would consult with his own team. What do you think about that? But if it was a junior dealer, he had 500 shares to buy or sell, well, you would stand back and let the boys get on with that, because they were learning to deal and they wanted to make a relationship so that they were going to be senior partners hopefully one day. So you let them get on with it and become friends and get on with their equivalents, they're the same age group. So personalities were very important. And the other aspect, I suppose, is from the broker's point of view, or the jobber, was knowing who you felt was the market in a particular stock, or who was discreet. I mean, some people had the reputation that I think I mentioned before. I mean, Jack de Lacquer was a great bear, certainly, when one first knew him. And therefore, if you wanted to buy some stock, he'd be a good chap to go to. Whereas Nigel Mordaunt, if you like, was always a great bull. And if you might pick him if you had stock to sell, because he loved sort of putting stock on the book. So knowing that the individuals was an important part, both from a broker's point of view and the jobbers, quite
what
definitely.
What was your approach to jobbing? Did you prefer to be a bull or a bear?
Initially, I think youth, you're optimistic, you're bullish. And it's only, you think, I mean, being a bull is a positive thing. You can't actually be registered as a bear. If you're on the share register as a bull, a bear is a more sophisticated animal. And I think on the whole, it really only comes more easily with experience. Because inflation, on the whole, stock prices have gone up. I mean, if you look at the index, I mean, it's whatever it is now, something over 2,000. In those days, I mean, 400 was the sort of top whack. So I think that, and until you've actually seen a bear market, and of course, initially, there wasn't a proper bear market until 1974 in our lifespan. I mean, pre-war there had been, but not in our experience. Shares on the whole had been on a sort of gentle uptrend. And then when you suddenly see what can happen, the prices just fall away. And experience tends to make you feel more bearish, if you like. And as I say, Nigel Morton became, I think he's one of the biggest bears I've ever seen in his latter days, having been an earlier bull. But so saying, I mean, we always try to balance our books to a certain extent, either on the bull tack or on the bear tack. In other words, we wouldn't be a bull of every stock we dealt in. And we had the figures at our fingertips the whole time, and that you would be a bull of, say, I don't know, £500,000 worth of stock on a particular book. And a bear of, say, $250,000, and obviously that was a bull point of view. You, if you had no particular point of view, you might be a 300,000 either way or whatever. But you would never be, or very rarely would you be just a bull or just a bear, because life didn't work out like that.
You mentioned the bear market in 74, which was quite a crash. Mm-hmm. How did you as a firm cope with that? Or do you have any personal recollections of what it was like being in the stock exchange when things did look very black, and when, for example, a firm like Ferranti announced it was in trouble, or a firm like Burma Oil?
Burma was the one, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Yes, who were reputed to be in some of the banks. There were rumours about NatWest. I can't remember if it was NatWest or just the Westminster Bank in those days. I think it was even NatWest. And I mean, I think they had to make an announcement that actually they were still solvent. Well, it's quite a harrowing experience. I think there was a gentleman, his name was John James of Bristol, and he had been predicting the market going down very accurately. And it had fallen from 200 to, what was it, 154, or thereabouts, I think. And when it got to 154, he said the next stop is 112. And that was around, that was sort of Christmas time, if I remember rightly. And then, fortunately, I think a group of institutions got together and said, well, look, this is ridiculous. I mean, we're all going to go under. Let's see if we can buy some stock at this level. And they very rapidly, I think, within about a fortnight, I mean, they pushed the index back up to 200, and that established a certain level of confidence. But it's very unnerving. And indeed, it was, as far as we were concerned, it was the only year when I remember actually that when I was a partner there that we actually lost money. Because it's so easy, if you're dealing in marketable shares, you've got a chance to remain a bear. I mean, if say you buy stock at £1, and normally you would hope to sell that at 20 and threepence, or 101 now. Well, if you then buy it at, in today's terms, 98, 95, 94, and you haven't sold any, well, obviously you're looking at a loss situation, assuming you're a bull. But in a marketable stock, what you can do is to buy at £1, and immediately sell it at, say, well, you look to see where you can establish a buy. It might be at 95, it might be at 90. Well, then you can cut that stock if you're a bull, or you can open a bear position at, say, 90, and then call them 85, 90. Well, that's comparatively easy to do if there's a market in the stock. But if the stocks are unmarketable, and most of the stocks, numerically in any case, were unmarketable in which we dealt, and you only had to have a few thousand, and if you bought them at a pound and then you buy them at 90 and 80 and you haven't sold a share, well, that's where you pile up stock. You try not to, but we always tried to make a price, and I think we were recognized for that, that there was always a price. I mean, in the old days, so-called jobbers used to say, well, they're 95, 100 nominal, which meant there wasn't a price, or sellers only. I mean, occasionally we would say buyers only, because we wouldn't sell a non-existent bear if you had to take over a situation, or a very unmarketable stock. Take, I don't know, Savoy B, if you like, where Charlie Forty was trying to buy them. We wouldn't ever sell a bear that company. We might have a few on the book and try and make a price, which is I used to do what I would try and do, but make a price in 50 shares. But throughout that period, we tried always to make a price, even if it was only in a few thousand shares or a few hundred shares. And I think that was one of the strengths of the thing. But there was a price to pay for that. But we felt it was correct, because otherwise, if you just said there wasn't a price in the London market, well, where's the London market?
About this time, a number of other jobbing firms, old, well-known firms, disappeared, like Francis and Praed, Blackwell, which I think got taken into WID.
Yeah.
What was the feeling in the stock exchange about these kinds of
disappearances? Well, obviously, it was a sign of the times, and I think David Blackwell actually had a very good business. He was the king of the oil market, quite definitely. We didn't deal in oil shares in those days, and there was a lot of business in them. And he was undoubtedly the lead in that market. And I suppose there were certain regrets, but on the other hand, I think that people felt that maybe if he was on his own, and in fact what happened there was that they tried to diversify, and they took over a firm called Acosta. And that was a big mistake. And so when they came to us, they were in a vulnerable position. And indeed, Acosta and his stocks came to us. But he built up a position of too many of the stocks I've described. He was a bull of them, and he couldn't sell them. Then he had a nasty loss situation, and that was brought Blackwell fairly close. As far as Francis and Praed was concerned, they were the gilt market, and I think they were sailing fairly close to the gun in a particular situation.
Yes. Well, I've already spoken to one of the former partners, gentlemen called Angus Ashton.
Oh, yes, I know. Yeah, I think that's...
Explain the circumstances, and the firm correct. Never quite recovered its reputation after.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
How did you feel now as one of the bigger jobbing firms? I mean, did you begin to feel that you you had greater responsibility than simply making a profit for your own firm, but then somehow the stock exchange depended a bit more on Wed Durlacher than on some of the smaller firms? Or did you still think of yourself primarily as traders and there too? To make it
no, I think, again, this was Esmond and indeed Pat Durlacher. I think one felt a very great responsibility to the market. In fact, there were times when I think, or thought, that we were perhaps too commercial. But on the other hand, there's no doubt about it, by doing that, I think we prolonged the existence of the jobbing system. Because brokers actually, they weren't envious of us. I mean, they used to think, Christ, I wouldn't want positions like that, and to make the size which we did make. And at the times, we had the most appalling losses. I mean, we really did. I mean, to lose $500,000 on one book in those days was quite a lot of money. And it didn't happen too often, and it couldn't have happened too often. But we did stick our necks out enormously. Obviously, when you made a price, you were hoping you were going to make money out of it. But on the other hand, we did feel that we owed a responsibility to the system, and I think all the jobbers, to be fair, who survived that period, and as I say, there were basically five of them, I think we all felt that we were contributing to the system, and you can't win them all. You've got to win 7 out of 10. And we felt a responsibility to that marketplace. But obviously we were quite keen to see the bottom line.
What was your relationship with the other jobbers like? Was it a very competitive relationship? For example, you could contrast the other four major firms with some of the smaller ones like Charles Worth & Co. And so on.
I think as the years went by and it became a question of the survival of the fittest, I think the relationship improved on the whole enormously. in the markets I was connected, I never believed in having a war with your opposition. It was totally counterproductive. And if brokers knew you, you never spoke to your opposition, they would play on that. And they'd get up to all sorts of tricks, like saying, I'm only dealing with you, when they were dealing with the other one as well, because they knew you'd never find out, because you never spoke to him. But I always went out of my way to talk to my opposition and get on with them and have a healthy market. No one jobber wouldn't have been healthy if he did all the business. You don't want to do all the business, as Dick said earlier. You could be embarrassed with a chap you knew he always dealt with you at times, because there were times where you didn't want to deal with him, however great a friend he was. But in the latter days, I would say that the relationships, on the whole, were first class with one's opposition. They were professional relationships. One saw oneself rather in the like as members of a sort of trade association, if you like, and there weren't many jobbers left, and there was no point in us all fighting each other. We reckoned there was sufficient of the cake to be split up, and obviously we wanted the largest portion, but didn't always get it.
Did you feel that the outside world understood and valued the jobbers, or did you feel that within the four walls of the stock exchange, outside the four walls, no one really knew what was going on?
Initially, I think the understanding of what a jobber did amongst the sort of financial press was pretty vague. I suppose one of the consolations was if you ever sort of found your name in the papers, whether it was, with your girlfriend or somebody else's girlfriend, you were always referred to as stockbroker, because they really didn't know what a jobber was. But in latter days, I think the press became more aware of what the function and the difference between the two. So I think the relationship and the understanding did actually improve when there weren't many of us left. But initially, I don't think I had a clue what we did.
Can I ask you a little bit about your own career with WID?
Mm.
Is there a progression with a jobber in the firm? Do you get moved around from market to market?
Yes. I think it's very important that one does, because all markets are different. I mean, I actually... long time ago, I started as a blue button on this joint book with Pinchin in the cable market, and you get certain brokers dealing in that market. I became authorized and a member on the food market, and we dealt in food shares and indeed paint shares. There were a lot of paint companies in those days, so it sounds a horrible mix, but I dealt in them for quite a bit. I then went on to the Leader book, which was called in those days, dealing in shares like Unilever, ICI, Court Holes, British Oxygen. They were the big market shares. Then I think I went in a spell for textiles. I certainly had a spell on the breweries. This was all dealing. And then ultimately, I'm a gutsy so-and-so in any case. I like my food. Drink maybe, and so I went back to the food book, and that's where I spent most of my sort of dealing days. And then ultimately, one had built up quite an experience then, as I say, because of all those different markets. And then when one got to more to a sort of supervisory role, one was still dealing, but one had an overseeing function for various other books. Well, you'd actually jobbed on them, so you knew a bit about it. Quite difficult, although you pick it up, but some shares are very different from others, and some markets are. But so it's all part of one's stock in trade, one's experience, which helps. And as one progressed up the sort of firm, and this was policy. We used to move all our dealers around up until I suppose eventually they would sort of find their niche by the time they were 30, maybe. But even then, if we were opening a new market. If ever we acquired a new firm, you always had to send one of your own people into that firm. It's no use just leaving them as they are, because they'll carry on their own ways, and we had to integrate them. So we tended to move people around, but you don't want to do it too often. But a junior, you would move more than a more senior person. It was all part of their training.
Did you have perhaps in your younger days, have any outstanding failures or successes.
Oh, God. There's plenty of failures.
Could you perhaps recall one or two?
Well, the worst one I've already told you, and it wasn't in my younger days, was that bargain, and that was the worst bargain I ever did, was to sell 2 million British sugar. That cost £500,000. I suppose I was very fortunate because one arrived at a time when there were so few people who had joined the stock exchange, and therefore one had a great opportunity. For instance, I remember I was working on one occasion that I was newly authorized, and both the partners, we were two adjacent books, and they were both away. One was on holiday and the other one was ill. So you were left to get on with it. And there was nothing like just getting on with it, to learn the job, so to speak. I think one of the greatest successes, if you like, was after Allied Breweries, yes, they tried to buy out trust houses. Oh, I don't know when this was, early 70s, I suppose. And we sold an enormous bear. The bid was off. They retained their stock, but they wanted to buy more after the bid was officially off. And we sold them a bear. I've forgotten what it was. Something like 10.